Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
You're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Lady Sue. When not on the air, my job is to eat and drink and connect people. I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear here, and working with my clients, which include chefs, sommeliers, big brand startups, those doing what's most innovative and delicious. First off, at the Green Market, we join Shane Lyons, the youngest ever grad of the CIA, 18 years of age. He is now chef partner at Distilled in Tribeca. And we're going to talk the first of the season squash, specifically kabocha. It's strangely warm this morning, a little disconcerting to see gigantic fresh tomatoes for sale in the middle of November. And then in just a few minutes, we'll welcome here in the studio with me chef partner David Waltuck of the brand new Elan, his second act after 30 years helming the legendary Chanterelle restaurant in Soho, which opened in 1979 and to which Brian Miller of the New York Times awarded 4 stars in 87. He talks finding love really early, dinner parties turned into the dream job, and sacrifice. Stay to the end. Because to wind it down, we'll talk with sommelier Marie Viron at Aldo Sam Wine Bar. It's a new spot by Le Bernardin's wine director, Aldo Sam. And we're going to chat why Bordeaux is being bashed and its big comeback. So let's go to the Green Market. I'm here with Shane Lyons, chef partner of Distilled in Tribeca, New York. Hey, Shane.
Hello.
So, tell me a little bit about Distilled. How would you describe it?
Distilled's a new American public house. So, we're in the heart of Tribeca. We've got this amazing cornerstone space that wrap around bay windows. And we really strive to be the place that you just want to be. We've made our goal to be a great neighborhood restaurant in Tribeca. And you know, thankfully, we've had a lot of support from the community since we've opened a year and a half ago.
Awesome. And congratulations on your recent 30 Under 30 Zagat win.
Thank you.
And also, he's one of the top 8 most eligible bachelors in New York City, according to Gotham Magazine.
Yeah, well, that's just one, you know, that's just one magazine's opinion.
Ladies, watch out for him at the Green Market. what are you looking at today?
Well, we're looking at kabocha squash, which I happen to be a big fan of. I'm from Colorado, and we grow a lot of kabocha squash. It's got a great, it thrives pretty naturally there. What I love about kabocha squash is it has somewhat of a dual identity. You know, it switches back and forth between sweet and savory and starchy and, or you know, really creamy. And you know, a lot of that has to do with how long it's been picked and its treatment since it was harvested. So with a kabocha squash like this, after it's freshly picked, you'd want to store it in a slightly elevated room so that those starches convert to sugar and ripen.
Oh, really?
Yeah, sure, and then ripen the gourd.
When you say an elevated room, you mean like a top floor?
Well, I mean, when I say elevated room, excuse me, elevated temperature. You want to raise the temperature a little bit so that those starches will convert into sugar. And there's a real methodology around aging these gourds the proper amount of time so that you get a really sweet flesh. Yeah, it's interesting. One of my favorite things to do with it is to simply roast it, split in half, a little bit of we use a Merguez spice blend that we make at the restaurant, lots of cinnamon, coriander, paprika, you know, heavy spices, and lightly dusted, a little bit of butter in the oven. salt, pepper, and let it roast 350 degrees for about an hour or so, maybe a little less than that depending on the size. And you get this really just soft, unctuous, sweet flesh. And from there, you know, sky's the limit on what you want to do with it.
Yeah, what I do like about kabocha squash is it's got some juiciness to it. Like it's a wetter, it's not a too dry and shrivelly squash.
Yeah.
And then it's got that savoriness, so you're not like basically eating something dry and sweet.
Right. It really does have the best of both worlds. Its texture is creamy, it still has some fiber in it. You know, it's toothsome.
Uh-huh.
To me, it's my favorite cooking squash, and I get really excited when it is this time of year because it means it's time for kabocha squash on the menu in some form or fashion. So
how are we picking the ideal kabocha squash?
So you want to look at... Sorry. Oh, no problem. You want to look for size and for color. You know, a good kabocha squash should be pretty rich green, not light. You see some of these have this real sunspot where they've been sitting here. They're not fully ripened yet. So these will continue to ripen after they're picked for a long time. So they'll come into their own. But some of these are really nice. Like this guy right here is nice and green, and you can tell that it should have a good weight.
Like a lot of other vegetables, it should really
reflect its size. And I mean, this is probably about 4 pounds or so.
Hmm.
So that's going to be
right.
Yeah. So it's got a real healthy, nice weight to it.
And when you age it, the flavors do indeed deepen and become sweeter.
It's that conversion of starch to sugar. You know, as any produce ripens, you know, it starts a really starchy carbohydrate, mm-hmm. and then it converts into sugar. And that's why we love fruits and vegetables as they get super sweet and at their prime ripeness.
Is there an ideal amount of time to ripen kabocha squash in your mind? If I'm getting it at the green market today and
They hit their peak within about a month and a half to 3 months of after harvest.
Really?
Yeah.
So after they've been...
Yeah, so they're great. They're great cellar vegetable. I mean, they're great for storage. You know, in Colorado, we grew up eating these year-round.
Why do they grow so well in Colorado?
The elevation is just right for it. And, I mean, they grow well in Colorado and California.
And in Japan.
Yeah, Japan, of course. So we just happen to be... I'm from Colorado. I'm very proud. We just happen to be at the right elevation and have the right terroir for it.
Mm-hmm.
And we grow a lot of muskmelons. We grow a lot of squash and pumpkin. We're very much known for our cantaloupe in the western slope of Colorado.
So tell us about the eating menu rather than the tasting menu right now at Distilled that we can go get.
Sure. So eating menu at Distilled is at the chef's counter, and it was our goal to make food that was really fun and focused. So we wanted to take the tasting menu idea and twist it on its head a little bit. And I don't want to give away all the secrets because we add a lot of what we call little buddies throughout the meal. And these little buddies might be a jungle juice jello shot in the beginning made with some really high quality liquor. And it could be next up it could be a freshly baked cookie break. You know, we think every tasting menu should have a cookie break in it. So the whole idea is to kind of set a new communal campfire where I host four people a night, and we allow them to feast with no rules around how it's to be coursed and what are the reasons behind it, and it's very free flowing and fun. So we've been very fortunate to have hosted a lot of these dinners, and people always have a blast. They leave happy and drunk and. It's a good time.
Shane is quite the showsman, so I highly recommend it, especially because he's now one of the most eligible bachelors in New York City. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Anyone who lands on a most eligible list, I just have to give him or her a hard time. Thank you, Shane of Distilled down in Tribeca. Welcome back to Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue on Heritage Radio Network. If you love what you hear, do connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Leyte Sue, that's LEITIHSU, at Heritage_radio, and then hashtag WOMSHOW, that's short for Word of Mouth Show. And with that, I am so excited to welcome people we like.
People we like.
Shh. chef partner David Waltuck of Elan, brand new above Union Square, formerly of the restaurant Chanterelle, a New York institution of 30 years. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
Congrats on the new spot.
Thank you.
The dumplings with the scallops and foie gras, delicious and delicate. And seafood sausage, gotta love those pine nuts in there. Reminds me of those See's candies where you have those nuts where you want to get to the next, like, nut. So you eat the whole thing easily. Mm-hmm. And we have to stop here to tell the story of how, the inspiration for the seafood sausage, your signature dish, and how it kind of beat its inspiration.
Well, I prefer not to brag, but...
You're going
to,
though, on my show.
No, I'm not.
Yeah,
The seafood sausage is something that I've made since before Chanterelle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's based, I believe, if I remember correctly, I saw an article by Gail Green where she mentioned having a seafood sausage at Taillevant restaurant in Paris. And that was about all the information that there was, except that it was served with a beurre blanc. And I just constructed my version of seafood sausage. And I put it on the menu at Chanterelle. I tried to take it off the menu, and there was an outcry. So I put it back, and it's been on that. It remained on that menu for the 30 years we were open, and it's back at Elan. I've embraced it at this point. I'm not running away from it.
And the tale goes that a customer at Taillevant told the owner of Taillevant that...
I happened to be dining there, and... At the end of the meal, we received a bottle of very good champagne from someone anonymous in the restaurant. It turned out that a client of Chanterelle's had been there and saw us, but didn't want to bother us, and sent us the champagne, and also told Monsieur Vrina, who's the owner, that we had a wonderful restaurant and that our version of seafood sausage was far better than his. He took that with good grace. He was an extraordinary man. And for years after that, we received Christmas card from him at Chanterelle.
To me, the seafood sausage reminds me of a really excellent Chinese fish cake.
Uh-huh.
The kind that you stick in a broth and it's... did you mean to do that?
I didn't.
It's exactly that.
I mean, it really is... kind of a take on classic French. I mean, you could take the mousse that holds it together and poach it as a quenelle,
mm-hmm.
or make a terrine. But instead, we use it to bind lobster, shrimp, scallops, pine nuts, and stuff it in a sausage casing.
You have a soft spot for Chinese food.
I do.
Where does that come from? Is that like growing up as a New York City Bronx kid? Or
no, definitely not. I mean, the Bronx version of Chinese food when I was growing up seemed exotic at the time, but I think that was just, that you could have snow peas. You know, that was really pretty exotic. That was a long time ago, by the way. No, I don't know. I have lots of friends who are Chinese that I'm close with and that I love eating with and cooking with, and I also think it's sort of the busman's holiday kind of thing. I love to cook Chinese food, like straight out Chinese food, not a version of Chinese food, because it kind of, I'm still cooking, which is what I love to do, but the rules are changed a little bit.
So you do make Chinese food straight up?
Yeah, for I believe 12 years, I think we went through the entire Chinese zodiac. We did, our staff party was Chinese New Year party. We were very unorthodox in that we never did it on Chinese New Year because I was always invited somewhere and I...
You didn't want to miss out on that.
I didn't want to miss out on that, and my Chinese friends were doing their thing, so they wouldn't have come. So I would, really cook my ass off and, fill up the walk-in with stuff that had nothing to do with Chanterelle menu and close on a Sunday and do this crazy, just like 50 different dishes kind of thing. And So it was for staff, it was for friends, it was for family. It was, I think, one year, there was one year that was really out of control where my wife basically, I think, invited everyone that she encountered, you know, within the few weeks before. I think there were cab drivers there. There were people there I'd never seen.
I look forward to being, I do the same thing with parties. Karen sounds lovely. So, new spot. People just because Chantal was made such a mark on New York dining, folks have to say this is your comeback restaurant, and there's just a lot of expectation. What's been the reception?
I think we've been very well received. I think that.
And was it scary?
Was it scary? It's funny. I mean, it wasn't scary opening a restaurant in 1979 because.
You didn't know any better.
Yeah, it just seemed like something to do, and it was very much less fraught in those days. I mean, there was no internet. You know, there was no. It wasn't the sort of feeding frenzy that it is now. And then this time around, I don't know. It just seemed like something I had to do, so I did it. I think if you start thinking about failing, or you start thinking about coming up short in some way, you sabotage yourself.
Well, you have a very... Chantrell is a very fairy tale... Very fairy tale story, which we'll get to in a second. But first, the art on the wall. Tell me about it.
At Elan?
Mm-hmm.
It starts with sort of the history of Chantrell. When we we first opened in Soho, and it was a very different Soho than the Soho that exists now. There was still a lot of factories, warehouses. It was very much settled by artists. I mean, you had to have a certificate from the city, which is an artist in residence, to be able to live there because it wasn't zoned for residences. I had a lot of sort of connection through a particular friend into that sort of community of artists. And because of where we were, we decided that putting art on the wall would always be excluding someone and including someone. And it would be controversial. But we did want to partake of the art that was going on there. So what we decided to do was to put the art on the menu covers. And so every 6 months or so, we would have a new menu cover. The inside of the menu was written by my wife, Karen. as those menus sort of were retired, we framed them and put them on the wall. In Soho, it was a hallway. It wasn't in the dining room. And then in Tribeca, it was in a sort of a little waiting room that you came into.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I wanted to keep the theme, but I didn't want to imitate what had been at Chanterelle. So we had a big empty wall, and we decided that it would be fun to have that be the art wall. And so and that would be kind of a curated installation that would change again every 6 months or so, big though, much more of a presence than the menu covers.
Very much like a changing of the stage.
Yeah, and because it hasn't changed yet, but when it does, it really will change the feeling of the restaurant. And made some inquiries and ended up calling Chuck Close, who dined at Chanterelle pretty often, and I saw it at various parties and such, and asked him if he had a suggestion of some young artist who would be willing to do this. And his response was, "What do you need some young artist? I mean, how about an old artist? I'll do it." And so he gave us a 16-foot tapestry, which is a sort of a, I don't know what the word is. It's five images. I was thinking diptych, triptych. I don't know how to go further than that. it's five images of Chuck. And that's going to stay there until January, and then something else will come.
The art roots of Chantrel and Ilan go much deeper than I expected. I read in the cookbook that you once had a restaurant staff who were dancers who lived around the corner.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that was sort of a specialty of ours at Chanterelle was to hire a kind of an eclectic group of servers.
Right, women before women were...
Yes, before there were women, female servers in basically any high-end restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
I believe Four Seasons was ahead of us on that. But
that's not a bad example to follow.
No, not at all. Anyway, we
and Bill Cosby did a...
Bill Cosby did a menu, yeah. I mean, they're not all of the menus were by artists, but they were not all by painters or visual artists. There were... There's a portrait in music of Karen by Virgil Thompson. There's a dance by Merce Cunningham. There's a kind of a random sort of I Ching kind of image that was done by John Cage. So anyway.
Where do they sit now, these various menus?
The menus, let me be clear, the actual menus that we used were not original works of art. They were based on, in general, based on something either that existed or was created for us.
Mm-hmm.
So they were just printed. I mean, we printed hundreds of them.
Do you have
So them? I have a collection of all of the menu covers. I have several collections of all of the menu covers, but some of them are just in storage somewhere.
I see an exhibit in the future. After a very quick commercial break, we're going to continue with David here live in the studio about a pretty fairy tale start. He found love in the dream job early in life.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue on Heritage Radio Network. I'm here live with David Waltuck of the brand new Ilan, and before that he helmed the 30-year-old Chanterelle. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So Chanterelle, being such a magical place, really at its very heart, is a mom-and-pop restaurant.
That's absolutely true.
It came out of a dinner party.
Came out of
many
a
dinner
series
parties.
Of dinner parties. Yes.
In your apartment.
Yep.
When you were like kind of a kid, like 23?
I was, 23, 20, something like that. I mean, my story is that I graduated college. I was supposed to be a scientist. I decided somewhere about halfway through that was just not going to work.
You didn't want to be testing ocean sediment again and again and
it
again
wasn't for me.
Dark lab.
And I loved food and I loved cooking and I turned out I was good at it.
you're that crazy kid. Your parents were slightly concerned.
They were concerned, but supportive. My mother passed away before we opened Chanterelle, shortly before, actually. The first night that we were open for business at Chanterelle in Soho, my father, who lived in the Bronx, came and peered in the window and saw that there were people there and then went away. He just had to reassure himself.
Are you kidding me?
Not at all.
Wow. And he ended up coming a couple weeks later.
Yeah, of course. No, he just had to reassure himself that we were doing some kind of business. It wasn't a totally harebrained idea. But back to the dinner parties, I was working for a while as a sous chef at a little restaurant called La Petite Ferme.
This is after he dropped out of the CIA.
I was a CIA dropout.
Yes, he took the celery out of the classic mix because he just felt like it. Yeah.
I'm a proud CIA dropout.
The best do dropout. That's what they say about Harvard.
So I worked lunch, and I was off in the evenings, and I would go shopping and play with food and make up stuff and work on stuff. And every month or couple of months, we would have a dinner party in this studio apartment on York Avenue. And it was like a play acting a restaurant in a way, because Karen would arrange flowers, she would select wines, she would write the menus, and I would cook this fairly elaborate tasting menu for 6-8 people. It's the standard story. People said, "You're really good. You should open a restaurant."
When people say that, it usually is not true, but
it worked for me.
And the dinner parties were, as you said, intoxicating in every sense of the word.
Yeah, there was a lot of wine and a lot of food. We were in a very catatonic state by the end.
All of a sudden, it was your hospitality and your food that. And it reminded you of when you would go to restaurants as a kid with...
Yeah, that was very sort of transformative for me. Because cooking at home, I didn't learn to cook from my mother or my grandmother. It was fine, but it wasn't something that my mother loved to do.
Mm-hmm.
But we often... would go to the theater, we would go to the opera, we would go to concerts, and that always involved a trip into Manhattan and dinner at a restaurant. And I couldn't get over that. I mean, it was that you went into this place and you could look at a menu and choose whatever you wanted from the menu, and they would bring it to you. And I always wanted to try something new. A lot of times that we went, it was to sort of the theater district, French bistros that were very common in those days. And, I loved the idea that that there was a beautiful plate of food, that it was care taken in presenting it. The whole thing just attracted me.
And my favorite line in the cookbook Chanterelle, written by our friend Andrew Friedman, co-written, dishes announced like late arriving guests. That's so beautiful.
Yes.
So I want to talk about Karen, your wife, who sounds utterly, utterly cool, by the way.
Well, you must meet sometime.
I'm looking forward to meeting her. She is, quote unquote, the front of house goddess, mistress of details. I mean, the prose is lovely, lovely in the book. You say that you would get excited about a trip down to Calusians to pick up some spices, but she, when she was just a kid, like in school, she'd go to live in France and Rome.
She did. She speaks French, Italian, and Spanish. She would say all of them badly, but it sounds good to me.
So what is it about the restaurants back then that were so, it was so common for the husband and wife team to to do a restaurant, and that worked. I don't see that as often these days.
No, but that's a real classic sort of European model, you know, where generally the husband is in the back of the house and the wife is in the front.
Mm-hmm.
And it works because it works really well because there is a kind of attention and potentially really disruptive antagonism between front and back. You know, there's often a real lack of understanding of the skill involved in either of those, you know, by the other, and the problems, the forces, the whatever, you know, the kitchen people, you know, don't want to hear about demanding guests, and you know, front of the house people don't want to hear about, you know, the sauce broke or something like that. Anyway, so it works well because if you have to go home with the person that's on the other end of it, and you know, you have to be able to work it out, and you have to be able to understand each other.
So why? Just wondering why is that much less common these days?
I don't know the answer. I would theorize that there's the first of all, I think that there's a real group core of very, very professional people in both the front and back of the house,
mm-hmm.
Which was somewhat lacking when I started. You know, there's the cliche of the servers that are out of work waiters. And you mentioned dancers. I mean, we had everybody that we had was not one of them was a professional waiter. And that was something we kind of actually sought, because the idea being that we wanted interesting, quirky, intelligent, creative people that were, you know, that were doing this and also doing something that fulfilled them in another way. In any case, so it's less necessary, perhaps, to have that partnership. And also, I think that there's, you know very well, there's a trend of chefs and restaurateurs opening multiple restaurants.
Mm.
You can't be in every restaurant. You can't have, you know, your partner or wife in every restaurant all the time. So you have to figure out a way to do that. And lots of chefs, I mean, you know all the names, have done extraordinarily well at that. I kind of don't really understand how they do it, because that's just not me. But
you very much want to be the one doing it in the kitchen.
That's really why I opened a restaurant again after being out of it for 5 years.
What were you doing in the 5 years before Elan?
Well, for a year, I kind of just settled my affairs and did a lot of private events and sort of got through that. Then I was asked to do some consulting for a company called Arc Restaurants that owns a bunch of restaurants, and they must have liked what I did because I was asked to be the executive chef, corporate executive chef, and I did that for a few years, and it was a great experience. I definitely learned a lot, especially about the business end, and also just a very different model of running restaurants and having restaurants. But I just really felt the need, and I really can't express it in any other way, to get back into it and to have a kitchen and make food and
it's like
do what I was kind of meant to do.
In this life, you're truly meant to do this. Well, opening Elan wasn't just sort of finding fancy investors and just sort of like, it wasn't easy. You talk about sacrifice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't want to blow it up out of proportion because I'm actually quite happy, but you know, I'm not earning the kind of money that I was earning, and I understood that going in. You know, I've had to move from an apartment that I have lived in for many, many years, which I own, so I'm renting that, you know, in order to make this whole thing work economically for me. mm-hmm. and for my family. I'm working a lot of hours and a lot of days, and I'm not a spring chicken anymore. so it has a certain, takes a certain toll, but it's worth it. It's totally worth it to me.
The life is short, and every moment has to be spent exactly the way you mean to spend it. How about Chanterelle? You're like 20-something kid. How did you get the 100K that it ended up costing to open?
Well, that was, I mean, it was, we had, I think, 26 investors
uh-huh.
for that amount of money. I mean, you know, my aunt, Karen's uncle, you know, odds
friends and
ends
family.
Of people.
But then, in the fairy tale, this sounds like a movie, by the way. It's so weird that, like, a young couple roller skated up to you to...
Yeah, we were building. We found this place. We had some of the money.
Mm-hmm.
This is another, you know, example of sort of naivete, really, because... and not thinking about failing. You know, we didn't have enough money to do what we wanted to do, but we started doing it anyway. We had this sort of almost finished, but... when not finished, restaurant with a stove that I could cook on. And we were just in this empty space late at night one night. And this couple roller skated by and peered in. And
that's so charming.
Saw us. Well, they were coming from like a roller disco. You know, I'm dating myself, but it was they're gallery owners in Soho, Lewis and Susan Mizell, and they liked us. They were interested. They liked food, and
ta-da!
They arranged for me to cook for a bunch of people, many of whom ended up putting money in.
And incredible. We were safe. Speaking of a roller disco.
Probably better not to.
You met Karen, you were in love, you were commuting between the CIA and New York, and you courted her, and you named some fantastic restaurants the best of that day. I mean, what was dating back then like? I have to ask you this, because my parents, I don't think they date, they just kind of spontaneously got married and spontaneously had me, so what was like a typical date? Or maybe you guys were weirdly atypical. Because
I don't know if we were. I guess you could call it dating. I mean, we went to restaurants. We went to them. We did what people do. We went out to movies. Went to museums.
Oh, so okay.
I mean, we you know, I was mostly either in at CIA or I was working.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't long before we got married.
But you had to ask her to go do something that wasn't just like you guys hung out vaguely. You know, because
no,
kids these days hang out vaguely.
No, we didn't just hang out. No.
You made your intentions known.
Yes, we did things.
So you and Karen went on a grand tour of Europe and ate at all the fine dining places, and describe to me what it was like on the plane ride back home.
Well, we did that a bunch of times.
Oh, a bunch of times. Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, I think you're thinking about when I was still working at the little French restaurant and before opening Chanterelle. Yeah, I think we had 2 weeks, and we ate at a lot of 3-star and 2-star restaurants, as many as we could not afford, but we pretended to be able to afford them and could squeeze in. I don't know. It was inspiring. I mean, we were kind of plotting this restaurant on some level, and we were talking about food and talking about my food and talking about what we would do. And it was exciting. It was a very exciting moment, exciting time.
You kind of just ran into your dream job in your early 20s, and I hope you have some empathy for those of us for whom it is not as natural. And in one in a couple of words, what would be your dream job? Let's say you didn't become a chef, maybe because for some reason. What would be your other dream job in life?
I don't really have another dream job. I don't ever think, I really would rather be doing this, or if I wasn't able to do this, I would be happy doing this. But something hands-on, something practical, something very kind of goal-oriented, problem-solving. Mm-hmm. What comes to mind is maybe medicine, just because there's tangible results. Whether in that you one hopes you cure the disease or you solve the problem. And cooking is a lot of problem solving all the time. You kind of invent the problems and then solve them.
It's such a pleasure having you on, David. Thank you so much for joining us. That was just David Waltuck of Elan and formerly the legendary Chanterelle. With just a little bit of time left to wind it down, we have on the line Marie Viron Sommelier at Aldo Somm Wine Bar in New York, a new venture from Le Bernardin's wine director, Aldo Somm. Hi, Marie.
Hi, Litchi. Hi, Litchi.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, of course. Thank you for having me.
So we're talking Bordeaux.
Yes.
How and why has Bordeaux been bashed or forgotten, do you think? Because it's kind of like has this like old white man, pardon me, feeling about it.
So I feel Bordeaux has been more bashed than forgotten. And we all know that Bordeaux wines and their prices went crazy, unfortunately. Especially since very successful vintages at 2000. So for this main reason of very high price, and especially in a very short period of time, I feel like a kind of new market like the American market had felt less interest and couldn't follow this huge rise of prices.
Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, it's still a very prestigious region, big name in wine, but we these days, I rarely find it by the glass on like sort of the Brooklyn hipster newer wine list. Why is that?
Yeah, for sure. I think Bordeaux wines have not a cool image. We can say that definitely, I think, but it's not necessarily bad because I think Bordeaux wines don't really tend to have this image of cool wines, this cool image, sorry. It's not, I think, in their DNA. And Bordeaux wines are more classics and kind of references in this sense. And it's like you always need some classics. Even if you are attracted by the new, by what is unknown, at a time to go further, you need those classics. So it's maybe not the hipster Bordeaux is maybe not on the most cool wine list in the city right now, but I feel like it's changing a lot. And when you see Bordeaux wines on Aldo Somm Wine Bar list, on Racine wine list, and also Perrenache, and I'm sure more to come, we can definitely see it changing.
So we are now seeing a reverse trend. So tell me about that.
I'm happy to notice this reverse trend. I'm in New York. I arrived 1 year and a half ago, mm-hmm. and I definitely noticed a few months ago, and maybe more than a few months ago, sommelier have more interest in petit chateaux. We call those petit chateaux, meaning more affordable Bordeaux wines. And actually, we have a lot in this region of Bordeaux, because we always speak about the 150 big chateaux, Grand Cru, which are the most expensive. We always spoke about them. But behind those, you have so many great value and great quality of Bordeaux wines. We just need a market curious enough as New York to explore those wineries.
So tell me one Bordeaux a bottle you absolutely love at Aldo San Wine Bar right now?
We have one from Côte de Bourg, which is one of those satellite appellations, actually, where you can find those great values. So one wine I love is from Côte de Bourg on the wine list of Aldo San, and it's called Chateau Martina. So it's in vintage 2010, which was a very good vintage. And on the list, you have it for $55. And I think for this quality, this vintage, and in this place of the city, I think it's still a very good value.
Excellent. It's so great to hear from you, Marie.
Thank you so much.
That was just Marie Viron, sommelier at Aldo San Wine Bar in Midtown. We had live in studio chef partner David Waltuck of Brand New Elan and the legendary Chanterelle. And at the top of the show, we also heard from Shane Lyon of Distilled Restaurant. We're live 2 p.m. Eastern Wednesdays on Word of Mouth, heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Leyte. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.